Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum. It's Ed Fallon with you here, folks. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Gateway Marketing Cafe. Gateway brings together the world's finest products with Iowa-grown foods and passionate personalized service. Check out Gateway Marketing Cafe. Thanks also to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry, who has 23 years in the real estate business. Joe is also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Contact Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. Hey, and thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. And I'd like to welcome Jeffrey Wise to the program. Hey, Jeff, how are you?
Yeah, good. Thank you, Ed.
How are things in the teaching world at Des Moines Area Community College?
They're good. Things are going well.
Students are engaged?
Students are engaged.
They're loving everything about the Trump administration?
Good thing is we have a lot to talk about, and not only that, or not just that.
Okay. Hey, so we do have a lot of ground to cover today. We're going to be talking about the Olympics, about the Super Bowl a little bit. We're going to talk about the mainstream media and how that's is kind of collapsing in some ways. Talk about China as an economic powerhouse. We'll also talk about the disturbing news about the START II treaty being ending, and what might that mean for nuclear proliferation. We'll talk about the relationship between the U.S. and Europe, the relationship between U.S. and Iran, and we'll talk about authoritarianism in the fall election, and also some good news about wind energy. And then Kathy Burns will join us later to talk about foodscaping for your city's future. First, Jeffrey, let's look at the Olympics, okay? Just starting this week, and I did not know that there was a way to watch it where you didn't have to deal with the... It's become a spectacle. It's become a way to advertise all kinds of products with minimal, really minimal coverage of the actual sports. And, you know, you're the one who alerted me to the fact that if you can find a way to tune into the Canadian broadcasting system, you'll get a much better look at the actual sporting element of the Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, it's just often interesting. I mean, even with the history of the Olympics. There's really been a kind of a long history, at least in our country, of more sort of nationalistic coverage. I mean, I remember when I was a child when Soviet athletes would win, and of course you'd have the obligatory story about how just right out of the diaper they were bending these kids and getting them ready for gymnastics, and oh my God, those godless communists, what they're doing to their children.
The Soviets East Germans. Germany was a separate country under the control of the Soviet Union, but. Yeah. They had the most amazing performances in the Olympics.
Oh yeah,
year after year,
absolutely. And you can look at this sometimes as almost humorous because of the absurdity of it. But I a lot of these international competitions, they're supposed to be about peace and goodwill and athletes competing against one another. But we know we're going to have to suffer through. If it's NBC, when Iranian athletes are there, we're going to, get some comments about, the politics of Iran and stuff. Certain countries, of course, and of course others not, are singled out. But I mean, overall, so much of the coverage in the United States is not only commercials, even above the actual competition, but so much of it is spectacle, and it's, stories about personalities and stuff. It's just, mm-hmm. All these pseudo dramas. There's the athlete who, especially if they're African-American, they grew up in a single family household and, they grew up poor. And I mean, and sometimes when you watch the Olympics from other countries. You were talking about Canada. You just get the Olympics. You know, you get the competition itself. You see all the athletes. You see a lot less commercials. And you really enjoy what the Olympics are supposed to be about.
They don't make it into a reality show.
100%. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I'm also interested in the fact that there are two countries that are forbidden from participating in the Olympics this year, the Winter Olympics. That's Russia and Belarus.
Yeah.
And I get it. I don't quite understand Belarus, but but Russia certainly is doing horrible things to the country of and people of Ukraine.
Yeah.
But, you know, Israel, the U.S., we seem to get a pass. There are other countries that are doing pretty horrible things to people, and they get a pass.
Yeah.
Why is it just Russia and Belarus?
Well, you know, and really there's really a quite a long history of this, you know, whether it's, you know, an illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq for how many years, et cetera. It doesn't seem to affect the participation of our athletes in a lot of international competitions. So, of course, you know, for the Israelis, the crowd was booing, et cetera, and you know, their athletes will probably be booed and jeered a lot. At the same time, which, you know, I'm not saying that's a great thing. It's just that the question is, you know, what countries get a pass for illegal wars? What countries get a pass for, you know, killing tens of thousands of civilians, and what countries don't? And
well, it says volumes about who really controls the Olympics.
Definitely. And you have that. And I mean, I don't know enough about it, but you could bring somebody on here who's a expert on you know, the politics of FIFA. They could talk about the World Cup, and that's another, you know, larger discussion. But yeah.
So the politics of FIFA, for example, presenting Donald Trump with the first ever FIFA Peace Prize.
Sure. And one hopes that encourages him.
I don't know what that hopes it encourages him
in the right direction.
I don't know what FIFA gained from that, but sure. maybe Donald Trump is now more of a soccer fan than a football fan, because he clearly does not like the NFL. I want to play a clip for you here regarding that.
The president criticized the new kickoff rules when he was at the Washington game. What's your reaction?
He doesn't even know what he's looking at. You know, he has no idea what's going on with the kickoff rule. So, I mean, I take that for what it's worth. And I hope he hears it.
that's the coach of the Kansas City Chiefs pushing back against Trump's inexplicable criticism of one rule. But he's been critical of the NFL extensively. And maybe instead of looking at FIFA and the Olympics, for sports untarnished by politics, you could count on the NFL, but there are those who would argue, of course, that the NFL is pandering to the woke base. But that's silly. I mean, there's nothing really woke about football. it's a very rough, sometimes violent game.
Yeah.
A heck of a lot of skill involved.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't really watched a lot of the NFL this year. I think that the halftime show is this year, which I won't watch any of it, but we'll...
Well, you're going to be watching the Turning Point USA's alternative halftime show?
I don't know what that would be, but it will probably appeal to a younger demographic, you know, because the music is...
Bad Bunny.
Yeah, I mean, it's centered around, you know, peace and social justice, and those are, you know, frightening words for... people who are authoritarian.
You know, to think that peace and social justice should be partisan is kind of ridiculous. I mean, we've had Republican Congress members as well as Democrats who have been real positive on building a more peaceful future. I mean, one year from Iowa, Jim Leach. I think of Mark Hatfield from Oregon in the past.
Sure.
You know, Republicans who understood that there was a need for diplomacy over militarism.
Yeah.
And so, just to see Trump getting kind of all bent out of shape about the NFL. But I love the fact that the NFL is pushing back. I mean, here we had Kristi Noem. Remember last October, Kristi Noem said, and I quote, "We'll be all over that place at the Super Bowl. I think people should not be coming to the Super Bowl unless they're law-abiding Americans who love this country." So I guess no foreign visitors welcome, right?
I would say the good news is a lot of the threats that have been leveled with this sort of militia, this, controlled by the president that seems to be doing a lot of things that it used to do.
You're talking about ICE.
That maybe as the protests grow and as the backlash, with public opinion polls showing that, barely maybe even a third of people in the United States approve of even a little bit of what ICE is doing, that those threats from the administration, that they'll start backing off on them. Hopefully they will, because if they don't, and if big government federal agents on the streets of our cities becomes more common, then it won't be long before the United States just becomes Hungary, Turkey, we have a little ways to go to get to the Russian Federation, but if we don't push back and stop it now, we'll move farther in that direction.
Now, you want to talk more about that, but the Super Bowl, and we're taping this program the day of the Super Bowl, so we have no idea how it turns out or whether ICE agents are there, as Kristi Noem threatened or really promised back in October. My guess is, and we'll see what happens, they back away because, more and more sports fans, average American sports fans are saying no to this kind of federal meddling with sports events. I mean, we've had all kinds of people do the halftime show. Mm-hmm. And Bad Bunny is not out of keeping with that with that kind of diversity. Mm-hmm. He just happens to rub the president the wrong way. And I guess even some of the rules in the NFL have rubbed the president the wrong way. But I mean, the way, I look at the way it plays out in the media, and I will say that overall, the media has been presenting a fair... a fairly objective take on what's been happening. I mean, I agree with you on the Olympics. I think the Olympics, the MSN, the mainstream media has been dismal in terms of any kind of real, digging into the problems with the way the Olympics are presented and controlled. I think that's different when it comes to the NFL. But I don't think overall the MSM, the mainstream media, is doing a very good job at defending democracy, and I don't think they're going to last. I think what we're seeing right now is an absolute erosion of their influence in this country. Would you agree?
Well, I mean, I think what you're probably talking about is just more of the legacy media, right?
So legacy, so I mean, mainstream media,
So CBS has become Fox News Lite. And that's true when you go into congressional offices and they're watching Fox on one station and CBS News on another. And that's a big disappointment because CBS had a long history of exceptional journalism.
Well, look what's happened to them.
Walter Cronkite. Yeah, 60 Minutes. Yeah. And now it's Fox News. But having said that, you still have NBC, you still have ABC, even though a lot of these companies like ABC, sold out and, in exchange for big tax cuts and the things they've gotten from this administration and his political party. They allowed the administration to pretty much, extort them in cases that they clearly could have won in a federal district court using the First Amendment and freedom of the press. CBS did that, of course. So did ABC. And there's some other companies that have done that. And so as long as this administration can shake down Bezos and Washington Post and these big corporations, especially extort them or I guess you could say bribery.
I'm not sure. In the case of Bezos, I'm not sure if it's a shakedown. I think what's the relationship there is mutually beneficial.
Oh, yeah. Well, some people call it like a $40 million bribe, to produce the documentary on the First Lady and things like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, what I see happening is, as you call it, legacy media in rapid decline, even as alternative types of media are ascending.
Sure.
Unfortunately, you get AI meddling with a lot of that, and it's hard to know sometimes what the truth is. Mm-hmm. And you get some pretty extreme voices accessing these new communication opportunities on both sides. I mean, I can think of a couple entities here in Des Moines on the far woke left who just use these opportunities, and they're off the wall, and they're not to be trusted.
Sure.
But I think actually we're going to continue to see an erosion of legacy media.
Yeah, probably. And, that's going to have some positive effects and it's going to also have some negative effects. I mean, one of the, if you think about when Nixon said, I'm not a crook, Everybody turned off the news, and everybody knew he was a crook. 24 hours from that, everybody knew he was a crook. You didn't even have to ask if he was a crook. 3 years after that, if a personality, a president did that today, right after he said, I'm a crook, there'd be, I don't know, 44 consecutive days of 455 panels saying, is he a crook? Is he not a crook? But Nancy Pelosi's also a crook. So nothing.
Right, deflection, yes.
Yeah, 24/7 news cycle, nothing ever gets decided. And the dangerous thing is then when the population doesn't really know where to find sources, or, you know, everybody's entitled to their own set of facts, which, you know, then you have an administration that says, you know, if we don't like facts, we'll just lie and make them up. We'll call them alternative facts. Yeah, or the Bush administration saying, you know, you reporters, you create reality, but reality's nice, but we're in power. We create the facts on the ground. You go keep on with your little reality scheme here.
It's not just Trump, in other words.
Well, yeah. And it's really a war against the ideas of the Enlightenment. It's a war against the idea of science, a war against the idea of reason, that somehow verifiable facts are some scheme of this elite group of people we shouldn't trust, which, you know, really leaves us with the situation of you know, tens of millions of people leaving their brains in the 16th century, and that's not a good thing.
Jeffrey, I want to talk about one more thing before we got to go to a break. The economy, specifically the global economy. Again, the U.S. has the largest economy in the world, $30 trillion by my last check. China, second, not even really a close second, $19 trillion. And then followed by Germany, $5 trillion, then Japan, India, Britain, France, Italy. But, you know, China is catching up. And more of the world are dissatisfied with the U.S., both our unreliability as an ally, both the, I mean, who knows what direction the current president is going to take the economy, or the next president is going to take the economy. And yet China keeps plugging away. And my sense is they are on track to become the global, you know, the global economic leader. And along with that, we might see a shift in terms of the global currency. What do you think?
I mean, big question. I mean, China, by, if you had 20 economists here, which you're probably lucky you don't, you know, maybe 10 of them would say that China has the largest economy based on what's called purchasing power parity. It's more a measurement of sort of like what you can spend. But the shocking thing about China's rise is you look at, let's say, South America, and you look at who the leading trading partner with South American countries, China. I mean, you look...
And Africa.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So you look all over the globe and you see that China, you know, moves around the world. China is not a colonial power. It's not an imperial power. It doesn't have a history of invading and occupying countries.
Well, tell Taiwan that, but...
Well, Taiwan's part of China.
Oh, okay. I mean, well,
yeah, legally it's part of China. But I mean...
We won't go there.
but China itself, you know, is a country that today really... walks around with a giant wallet full of trillions of dollars and invest. If I have students from different African countries, it's actually interesting because if it's international relations, you have different perspectives on China. You know, some of the African students will say, hey, they help build infrastructure, they help blah, blah. Others say, you know, it's economic colonialism, et cetera. I mean, it's certainly mixed bag. But in terms of the currency, I don't see that changing because the Communist Party, which isn't communist at all, there really isn't anything in China that's communist, but nevertheless, that's what their party's called. But the capitalists in the Chinese Communist Party, a lot of them really do not really like the United States being the dominant currency because their exports to the United States are a lot cheaper. I mean, you go to Walmart, you know, made in China, made in China, made in China, Walmart, made in China, you know.
And little American flags made in China.
Absolutely, absolutely. Wave them at the Olympics, you know. Yeah. But and so you have a situation where the really there's debates within China, and really it's to the benefit of a lot of capitalists around the world to enjoy the market of 340 million people with money and have the dollar as the more powerful currency. It's, you know, the other thing is the tariffs themselves, you know, that have been leveled against China. I mean, China hasn't flinched, and they've really, unlike Europe, really been able to push back strong against the administration, and the administration has backed down now over and over because China just has far too much leverage now.
And they're going to get more leverage.
In terms of economic development around the world.
Got to take a short break here. This is Ed Fallon with my guest Jeffrey Weiss. He's a poli-sci prof at Des Moines Area Community College. When we come back from a short break, we're going to talk about the end of the START II treaty and what that might mean for concerns about nuclear proliferation. Back in a minute on the Fallon Forum.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks again to our sponsors and partners, including Catholic Peace Ministry. CPM promotes peaceful resolution to war and the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com. Thanks also to Westrum Optometry. Dr. Joel Westrum and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish. The clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrum Optometry. Hey, Ed Fallon with you here, folks, with Jeffrey Weiss. Disturbing news last week, and we saw this coming, of course, but the START Treaty, START II, I guess, ended. It expired, and the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said it was a grave moment for international peace and security, because right now, I mean, we've got what? Each side, Russia and the U.S., have, what, 1,500 strategic nuclear weapons deployed, and we have more than those. Those are the ones that are already set to launch. And there's no more reductions that are going to happen now. And of course, it's going to encourage China to continue to build its arsenals. This is, it's insane to me that this is happening. It's embarrassing to me that the legacy media and other media outlets aren't paying more attention to this. I'm glad the head of the UN is speaking up about it. I don't know why more people aren't listening and thinking, hey, this needs to be pushed back against. Yeah.
Well, I know, Ed, you have a long history of working against nuclear nonproliferation, et cetera. So I know that, you know, this is...
No, working against nuclear proliferation.
Or
yeah, you said that backwards.
I always do that, yeah. Wow.
I'm glad I caught that. All right.
Given your spot at Raytheon, you were working to build more nuclear weapons. Oh, yeah. Oh, no. Okay, wrong person. No. Okay. So, you know, the five permanent members of the Security Council, Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea have nuclear weapons, but 90% are produced by the United States and the Russian Federation. So really, this is the first time since 1971 that you haven't had an arms control agreement between those two countries. Now, the President of the United States turned down a year extension with the Russian Federation and said, we can get a better deal. We meaning we're going to bring China into this and the three countries are going to make a deal.
But you think they'd want to do that before the treaty expires, if Trump was really serious about it?
Of course.
And, you know, and some of what Trump has said about nuclear weapons, I mean, I could have said it. You know, he's concerned about it.
Sure.
But then when you look at the actions or the lack of action, you think otherwise.
Well, yeah. And then some of the conversations he's had with especially in his first administration, with some other members of administration, like, you know, well, can we use these, you know, are a little more frightening. And really usable nuclear weapons, I think, are, I mean, Russia Federation, of course, usually around the issue of Crimea is when the president of the Russian Federation brings up using nuclear weapons. They're probably extending their capabilities in the Black Sea, I'm guessing. And
Russia is.
Yes, exactly. And then there is question whether they would use them. Both the United States and the Russian Federation have a nuclear doctrine that if they're losing a conventional war, they reserve the right to use them. So Russia's not losing that conventional war. They're winning it, and it should end any day, hopefully, if the countries of the world get together and try to end it.
Probably not going to end on a good note for Ukraine.
No, but better than what it will end with for Ukraine 3 months from now, or 6 months from now, or 9 months from now, or 12 months from now. But then again, Europe is, you know, loving war. you know, so
Europe is loving war. I want to come back to that.
Yeah,
that's interesting and
confusing. At least in the case of Ukraine, they're.
So anyway, I mean, I think it's great that we have a head of the UN who's calling out how bad this is.
Sure.
And calling for the world to address the problem, the lack of a treaty, the lack of any attempt to continue at reducing the threat. But I think we need a global peace movement like we saw back in the 80s. Millions and millions of people mobilized, marching, lobbying Congress, running for office, helping candidates and politicians move forward. I mean, that's where these treaties came from, was a vibrant peace movement that pushed for it to happen.
Absolutely.
And we need that again.
Well, and the international treaty to abolish nuclear weapons has, you know, far more than 100 countries that have signed up for it. And, you know, of course, the 9 that don't have nuclear weapons, of course, haven't. So
the 9 that do have. I'm here for you.
Yeah, I need another.
I'm your grammar police, Jeffrey.
I needed another cup of coffee this morning. But yeah, so really, I mean, I agree with you. We do need an international movement, and we just need more and more countries that are signing up for that treaty. Yeah. And, you know, the nuclear nonproliferation treaty, where you have the 9 that have them making a good faith effort to cut down their arsenals and eventually not have any, in exchange for the others that have nuclear energy not weaponizing, it has to be strengthened, you know. And there's where I do point the finger somewhat at the Russian Federation and the United States. Well, and China right now is moving from what they call minimum deterrence nuclear to maximum deterrence, which means,
more weapons.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. It's very disturbing.
Yeah,
and, you know,
it has to be pointed out that
there is a small element of the corporate universe that have a very significant financial benefit to continuing this arms race.
Right.
And, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, they were not only called out for their role in encouraging the proliferation of nuclear weapons, but one campaign that comes to mind was a group called InFact organized a campaign against General Electric. Specifically, GE was targeted for their role in making nuclear weapons, and it had an impact.
Yeah,
there was a boycott against GE, and it had a huge impact. And, you know, that has to be, we have to remember, this isn't just about machismo and global, global dominance. It's also about companies, corporations getting filthy rich off continuing this arms race.
Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and General Dynamics, a lot of these companies really, I mean, just brazenly, they will advertise today, you know, how they're affiliated with the military-industrial complex, which when we were growing up, I mean, they would never do. They would always try to hide that. But everything, there's not a lot of shame going around.
Because I remember GE had the slogan, GE, bringing good things to life.
Right.
And in fact, turned that in, GE, bringing nuclear war to life. It was very powerful.
One
thing you said to me recently that I'm concerned about, but I think it deserves a little conversation, is Europe is finally saying, you know, the U.S. can't be trusted. I mean, we see far-right movements in Europe as well. And in some countries, Hungary, they have taken hold. Other countries, the Netherlands, France, even Germany, you see a rise in far-right power, but they have yet to really become dominant and centralized and in control like it has here.
Yeah.
And so I think, and the problem is, you know, we have a very fickle electorate, and we have a system that allows that these huge shifts in the political fortunes from one election to the other. Mm-hmm. My impression is Europe is saying, we're fed up with this. We can't trust the U.S. We can't trust the people of the U.S. to deliver a fairly consistent form of government. We can trust Canada, but the U.S. is not an ally anymore that we can rely on.
Well, I mean, the European Union sitting down recently with China. I mean, not because China's a bastion of liberal democracy.
No,
but
not at all.
Yeah. So, but, you know, the United States is the only country in the Western world right now where the extreme authoritarian right, you know, controls power and controls all the branches of government. The far-right party in Italy, most of the positions of that party are in line with the Democratic Party. So what is called far-right in Germany is usually based on immigration policy, and it's based on xenophobia and other things, but it doesn't reach the level of direct suppression of voting, calling upon your political party to seize the elections in 15 states.
We want to talk about that too later.
Yeah, so.
So I mean, I don't follow. I mean, and then you got Trump threatening to take Greenland. I mean, how do we not expect Europe to say, we're gonna find different friends?
Yeah, I mean, and Europe finds itself a little bit on the outside. I mean, the two countries that dominate cloud capital are the United States and China, and the Europe is on the outside looking in on a lot of things, and maybe European countries who are part of the EU will try to get it together and have some different kind of security balance, mm-hmm. and not necessarily be as the sort of a lapdog of the poodle, what they used to call Tony Blair, you know.
the poodle,
you know, so.
Well, hey, so I want to take a look at...
Although we do like poodles.
They're a good breed of dog.
Yeah, they're not a bad breed of dog. A little... I don't know.
You like
a little
poodles.
Moody, but yeah.
No, you like poodles.
Okay. I like all almost right. all. I like all. Look, the state of humanity. I like almost.
I'm
all
not a
dogs
huge fan of poodles.
Yeah,
I mean, whatever. Yeah. Okay. So I want to look at play you a clip from Onidea News. I'm not familiar with them. Onidea News,
okay.
About the U.S. military buildup off the coast of Iran.
The skies over the Middle East are filling with American power. More than 112 U.S. Air Force C-17 military transport planes have landed or are heading toward the region, one of the largest airlifts seen in years. Heavy equipment, missile defenses, and thousands of troops are moving into position. As Washington talks peace with Tehran in Oman, the Pentagon is preparing for war.
So... we have this huge military buildup off the coast of Iran. We saw that happen off the coast of Venezuela, and we know where that led. Mm-hmm. Iran is not Venezuela.
No.
It's a lot bigger. It's a lot more powerful. Mm-hmm. You can't just waltz in there and make off with the Ayatollah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what is the U.S. plan? Is this a bluff, or is this going to be, are we going to see another... attempt at regime change like we did in Venezuela. Yeah.
I mean, we don't really know. I mean, it could be that if this current administration wants to divert attention away from, what's going on domestically, that they would start a war with Iran. I mean, to start a war with what, population of 90 million, about what, 60-65% Persian, Iran is of course known as the land of the Aryans, Indo-European peoples that, well, not those kind of, I mean, Hitler changed Aryans, meaning
sure,
that
I know
a little
what you
bit.
Mean, yeah.
But Iran can do a lot of damage, to Israel. Iran can do a lot of damage to U.S. military facilities in the region. And the thought of if you could somehow get rid of the theocratic republic in Iran, and that what would come after that would be something better, may not, in fact, be the case.
Yeah, it worked really well in Afghanistan, didn't it?
Well, and yeah, I mean, it was what, 20 years, and the Taliban's back in power. So.
And look at Venezuela. I mean, who did Trump replace Maduro with? His vice president. I mean, so yeah. There's, you could argue that it was a regime change without really changing the regime.
Yeah.
It was really just a way to get the guy who was in charge out so we could have greater
oil
access
deals.
To the oil.
Yeah.
Is that what we're expecting to see
yeah,
happen
I mean,
in Iran?
I mean, you know, I mean, Venezuela, you know, you talked about the dollar, you know, in the global economy. And, you know, there has been some speculation that Venezuela, you know, going to trade what used to be petrodollars in another currency, and that the move away from that does frighten the United States. And that would be another impetus, I suppose, to attack Iran. But, in that region, it just seems to be the United States and Israel have a similar vision, and that vision is, you know, war and instability and weapons contracts and a lot of those other things and access to oil.
Hey, we got to take a short break. This is Ed Fallon with Jeffrey Weiss. Going to come back in a minute with a conversation more locally or domestically focused on the some of the developments relevant to authoritarianism, particularly concerned about the possibility of the 2026 election being corrupted. But I want to share also a victory we've seen thanks to 5 judicial rulings that have gone against the president and in favor of renewable energy. Back in a minute with you on the Fallon Forum.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Story County Veterinary Clinic, where Dr. Kim Holding has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Thanks also to Architecture by Synthesis. Owner Mark Clipsham asked that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. All right, Ed Fallon with you and Jeffrey Weiss with me in the studio here, recording this program on Sunday, February 8th, just a few hours before the Super Bowl. So we don't know how that turns out. But I'm more concerned how the fall election is going to turn out and the incredible rise of authoritarianism in this country that has moved pretty quickly. I mean, between the, you know, the collapse of some mainstream media outlets, I mean, Washington Post most recently, and the capitulation of others, as we've talked about earlier, doling out huge sums to Trump for, you know, lawsuits that were questionable. Universities also capitulating, law firms, corporations, you know, not the NFL, or many local governments, or even local law enforcement who are standing up to the president. But we've seen a very rapid, you know, pace of movement toward full-fledged authoritarianism. And I don't know if you saw what Rachel Maddow had to say about this, Jeffrey. She said, speaking strategically, anyone who studies movements like this in any country, anywhere in the modern world, will tell you that keeping the pressure on a would-be authoritarian state is never more important than when they are wobbling, when they are on the defensive, when they're losing their will, when they're falling apart, which right now they are. Jeffrey, is Matt all right? Is the administration wobbling?
Yeah, I mean, I think there has been, the protests have gotten larger. There is some pushback now on some fronts within the party that the president leads. It is true that it has to be now, because once an authoritarian regime starts changing enough institutions, it can be too late. We don't really know when that point will be. you know, when you and I were growing up, if a president stood up and said that a political party should take over the elections in 15 states, and if they had the director of national intelligence
Tulsi
seize
Gabbard,
ballots right? yeah. in a state, they would be impeached and removed from office within 24 hours. So the fact that one of our two political parties goes along with that and doesn't have a problem with that is right. means that it is possible that the 2026, you know, congressional elections will not, national elections will either not take place, or they will be suspended.
Corrupted
or they
somehow.
Will,
sure.
Yeah, or just, you know, the level of gerrymandering and the level of corruption. I mean, it might only be a few seats that you would have to steal. So, yeah, I mean, we don't really know. We're in uncharted territory, and the more people that are on the streets, the more people that are pushing back in the courts, you know, the Harvards of the world and the universities and colleges that are you know, pushing back against,
not
know,
the Columbias of the world,
no,
University.
No, pushing yeah. back against,
right.
you know,
Harvard, yeah.
Pushing back against big government trying to take over universities. I mean, this is big government to the extreme, and it's big federal government. And,
yeah.
you know, we have a strong history of federalism in the United States. I think it's been one of, you know, despite the fact that the president's republic is a really awful
well, and the Republican
form of
Party
government,
used to,
federalism has saved us in some
and
respects.
And the Republican Party used to very vocally defend federalism, defend states' rights.
Well, yeah. I mean, there used to be these people called conservatives, you know, that now I suppose that would be, you know, Chuck Schumer and a handful of the Democratic Party would are conservatives. Well, it's just like I was saying, you know, Hillary yeah. Clinton and Barack Obama would be conservatives in most of Europe. And
yeah.
really the alternative for Germany or even the prime minister's party in Italy, a lot of their policies are just Democratic Party policies. And so that's why these labels. But yeah, I mean, a tenet of conservatism is local control.
Yeah.
A tenet of conservatism is tradition, status quo. And adherence to the Constitution.
Would you,
and those traditionally were decent values. Like I said, I guess you find them amongst, you know, a handful of people in the Democratic Party today. But we really do need more of that sort of classical liberal, classical conservative tradition. Because, you know, big government did not tell libraries what to do. I grew up in the United States where, you know, you don't always like your librarians and maybe they don't censor the right books.
Well, they're often
crappy.
But
you let them do it. Yeah, I mean, you let them do it. It's not for big government.
Well, and now we
to
have
stick
government
their nose into every theory and that's taught in a college.
And now
class.
We have government saying that libraries can't collaborate with schools.
Yeah,
which is insane. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, this is the party that has talked about again federalism, about states' rights, about
yeah.
about even local government. Local government should be in charge of local stuff. And now you have the state government here in Iowa and elsewhere, and the federal government coming in and basically usurping control.
Absolutely.
And it is so contrary to what the Republican Party has traditionally stood for.
Sure.
And I mean, again, my biggest concern is, again, as we've talked about, is they're going to try to do something to totally corrupt the fall election, because Trump and his people know that the biggest check against his power would be a Democratic Congress.
Yeah.
And they also know, they also see what's happening,
yeah.
the polling and even some,
sure.
you know, special elections and midterm elections have shown that the Democratic Party, or Democratic candidates generally,
yeah.
are faring very well
yeah.
and receiving yeah. more support from the electorate than they ever would have
well,
last fall.
And the Democratic Party, in some respects, is growing in popularity as people have seen on the national stage, the mayor of New York City, the mayor of Chicago, the mayor of Minneapolis, the mayor of Portland. They've observed these mayors who now are on a little bit more of a national stage, and they're showing a different way to govern, which is actually that government can be your friend, that government can provide services. It doesn't have to,
right.
you know, stick a weapons-grade military gun in your face and, you know, shoot you to death. But it can help you get health care. And,
yeah.
you know, health care is a better vision than
and reasonable
militarism.
And protection. I mean, law enforcement plays a very important role locally. It has had problems, but, you know, if you've been burglarized, hopefully you've got a decent police mm-hmm. department that's going to do something about that. If you've been the victim of a crime,
yeah.
if there's an accident, I mean, there is a very legitimate and helpful and respectable role for local law enforcement to play. But yeah, I mean, back to the election. I mean, I think this is a very, very serious concern. I'm going to play a clip from NBC News about Trump calling to nationalize voting.
The Republicans should say, we want to take over. We should take over the voting in at least 15 places. The Republicans ought to nationalize the voting.
Given that the Constitution dictates elections be run by the states, the president's comments triggered Democratic outrage.
I don't see this as a distraction. I see it as an actual threat. He has said out loud what he wants to do.
And polite pushback from top Republicans.
It's always been the responsibility of the states to administer elections.
I want to see elections be honest.
President Trump pressed late today, insisting there are problems with elections in multiple states.
Horrible corruption on elections, and the federal government should not allow that. The federal government should get involved.
It comes amid growing alarm among Democrats following last week's FBI raid of a Fulton County, Georgia election center. The FBI seizing hundreds of boxes of ballots and other documents related to the 2020 election, which the president has repeatedly and falsely claimed was stolen.
So, Jeffrey, your comments on that?
Well, I have to actually comment, though, on the way that is reported.
Okay.
Every single story in mainline legacy media is a he said, she said, two sides. And can that really, does that have to be reported that way? I mean, how about instead of getting the Democratic reaction, like, you know, every story is WWE, that instead... You know, you ask a historian who says this is unprecedented in United States history, you know, that this is clearly something, you know, that years ago a president would have been impeached within 25 minutes and removed from office. I mean, every story is presented through the prism of he said, she said, and it's all a competition between a red team and a blue team. And it's really not much different than the Super Bowl. And
or the Olympics?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Neil Postman's book years ago, Amusing Ourselves to Death, he nailed it. He said that everything serious in the United States was being portrayed through the lens of entertainment and through the lens of, and, you know, it's really, a lot of it is not any more sophisticated than a Scooby-Doo cartoon.
It reminds me how climate change used to be reported. You would have one scientist who talked about how it was a problem, and another scientist who was in denial.
Right.
And then I remember, I think it was John Oliver who pointed out that, you know, 97% of scientists say that climate change is real, it is happening, it is serious. There's, you know, 3 out of every 100 scientists think that it's not a problem.
Right.
So we're gonna represent that reality here tonight. And they had Bill Nye on and brought in Bill Nye and then brought in 96 other, you know, climate scientists and then 3 deniers. And it was a hilarious skit with the studio full of all these scientists arguing with each other.
Yeah. Well, it's in part why we live in a country where people will say, you know, evolution is just a theory, you know, not that much different than my theory for why my sister's depressed. You know, fundamentally not understanding. You know, it's like I say to my students, you know, you don't run around saying, you know, gravity is just a theory, so I'm going to climb on a water tower and jump off and test it. I wouldn't advise
It's not just a theory, it's the law.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I definitely don't advise, you know, testing gravity at
that level
either.
And I think we would be wise not to test climate change either, but we're doing it. But hey, so on the climate change front, some good news. Trump hates wind energy, and there's a lot of speculation that the reason is he's got this vendetta against wind turbines is because back in 2012 he had a court case. He tried to stop an offshore windmill project next to his golf course in Scotland. He thought it ruined the view. Because that's so important. You know, his view is more important than, you know, Scotland's energy independence. And so he lost. And the thinking is he's been against wind energy ever since. And so he's tried to stop wind construction, wind farms, even some of them that are like 75% done off the coast of New England, Virginia, New York. And federal judges aren't having it. I mean, there have been 5 cases now where in all 5 cases, the judges ordered the administration to allow the construction to continue. And that's just then. The 5th time was just this past week. So, and then one of them is the Sunrise Wind Project. I think that's off the coast of Long Island. It's expected to deliver enough renewable energy to power 600,000 homes in New York. You know?
Yeah. I mean, life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, John Locke, and then, of course, it was changed by Jefferson to say happiness is the premise of our Constitution. You know, what did Madison say? We have to write a Constitution to protect those who have property from those who don't, the creditors from the debtors. That's the foundation of our Constitution.
So Jefferson and Madison, improvements over Locke.
Well, and so, you know, presidents can try to get control over the economy. Wasn't it Truman that talked about nationalizing the steel and things like that? And they just don't get very far because, as you know, federal district judges are, that's one thing about the Constitution, the protection of private property, life, liberty, the pursuit of property is pretty strong still in this country.
But I mean, this is encouraging. I mean, again, back to what Rachel Maddow said earlier, you know, we are seeing a march toward authoritarianism, but there are lots of obstacles being thrown in the way of Donald Trump and the people that want to see this this radical shift of control from three branches of government to one branch of government run by a strong guy.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, the French call us hyper-capitalistic. We are fiercely individualistic.
Yes,
and
for better or worse.
Yeah, for better or worse. And in some sense, that may be a lot of the pushback that, you know, a lot of people do not like to see big government, you know, sticking guns in people's faces and trampling on people and taking away your Fourth Amendment right, you know, not having a warrant, and maybe our individualism. You know, there used to be these people that talked about, you know, during the Obama administration that the federal government was getting out of control, but, you know, they had the Second Amendment to protect them. And so, you know, Obama won't try anything with these federal agents, you know. So, you know, maybe some of those people will return. We don't want them invoking the Second Amendment. We want them invoking the First Amendment. But at the same time, you know, big government. Yeah. We have a strong system of federalism. We should adhere to our state and local governments.
Jeffrey, thanks so much for joining me today, folks. Jeffrey Weiss, political sci prof at Des Moines Area Community College. Ed Fallon with you here back in a minute. Kathy Burns joining us to talk about foodscaping for your city's future. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design build services for high performance, low maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help through the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay negotiated fee basis. Contact David Drake, familypsychiatry.com. With Kathy Burns. Kathy, welcome to the program. And what have you got for us today in terms of farm and food?
Well, guess what? It's once again, we're talking about
our suggestion to the city of Des Moines to become the local food capital of the U.S. And
other cities will want to jump on that.
Well, you know, there's a city that we're going to talk about that has the jump on it. We're going to use that as an example. But one of the main components of a city's local food scene isn't just having people grow food in their yards, but it's public plantings. It's plantings on city-owned property. In other words, foodscaping with your own city property.
Right. Yeah, and we've seen some of that happening in Des Moines. But, you know, there's so much potential. I mean, you can have fruit orchards everywhere, strawberries everywhere. I mean, maybe right now this is, actually, we're very fortunate to be in a neighborhood where we've got neighbors who have 12 maple trees that we're tapping.
That's right.
Maple syrup.
Yeah. And we'll have some syrup from that later in the spring. Well, the city of Augusta, Georgia, has really gone full scale with their local food scene. And they've got an initiative called Georgia's Growing Augusta. And it's intertwining the components of the arts, agriculture, and agency. And they are doing that to, quote, create opportunities for individuals and businesses to thrive.
And foodscaping is an important part of this?
It is a big part of it. And they see edible landscaping as low cost and high impact. I mean, right. What more does a city want to do than something that's low cost and high impact?
Right.
So helping improve food security. It supports pollinators, it creates opportunities for community engagement, and really just makes sure that the city is ready for anything that climate or pandemics have to throw at.
And I would think it would be particularly important in neighborhoods that are historically underserved. I mean, I used to live in a neighborhood that had, our grocery store was a quick shop, you know,
where
you can get junk food. And if you've got If you target some of these projects for neighborhoods that are underserved, that's one element of fresh food that becomes accessible.
They really do cite the communities and the neighborhoods with food deserts as priorities, and they involve the use of what they call underused city-owned spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you need to stop there. Take space that you're already using for regular landscaping and try to transition that to a foodscaping. You don't have to just take what's not being used already. You can purposely renovate all your space to be food producing.
Yeah. I mean, one problem we have here where we live, nearby we have the interstate and we have a very busy road called Martin Luther King Parkway, and that's one way. And then next to that is 19th Street, one way the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
And in between these three busy roads are all this empty land that, I mean, they have planted some trees there. Took them long enough. But that could be a great spot for additional foodscaping.
Mm-hmm.
And also using edible plants like Juneberries.
Mm-hmm.
As a snow fence, instead of putting up a big plastic fence every year. That would save money.
Yes, and I hope that they will look at that idea again. To the city's credit, they did take our original idea to transform that large, underused space into an orchard and edible foodscape place, but they did take that idea and establish it at a nearby park in a community of need. So that was an exciting event. We've talked about the public orchard planting, and that is food for personal public use when it's ready.
Now, some places like West Des Moines, another city, kind of a growing suburb, they have ordinances that don't allow you to grow food in public spaces or even in your yard sometimes.
Isn't that ironic that the space that is closest to you where would be the easiest for you to pick your food is the space that people in some cities don't allow their folks to grow food.
Yeah. So, and I guess, you know, if you live in one of those cities that prevents you from growing food on the strip of ground between the sidewalk and the street, or in your front yard, or that prevents you from having chickens or bees, you know, change those ordinances.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, And I know it can be a big struggle. We had one city north of us, Ankeny, where it was a huge fight. And in the end, the small change only helped a few people who wanted to raise chickens.
Yeah, so it was a little disappointing, but they made some progress.
Well, good to see what's happening in Augusta, Georgia, yeah. Kathy. Thank you. And thank you for joining me today.
Mm-hmm.
Folks, thanks to our guest today, Jeffrey Weiss, and also to our production squad of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Denneman, Charles Goldman, Kathy Burns, and myself, Ed Fallon. Thanks also to our small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Westrum Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and real estate agent Joe Henry. Thanks also to our nonprofit partners, Catholic Peace Ministry, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. And finally, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for providing our bumper music. We'll be back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.